You found it.
Now don't forget where you put it.
Welcome to the Lisa Show.
Are you a history buff? Coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to hear inspiring stories of the impact of World War II nurses.
And prepare yourself, a world first that will change the way you look at money. I'll tell you about it coming up in your morning buzz. We never know what life is going to throw at us, and one day we could feel completely healthy, and then the next we could be sitting in a hospital bed, unsure of what's going on. We never think much about our mortality, but then something traumatic happens, and it seems to be the only thing that we can think about. This can lead to a new set of mental health issues that last far beyond the physical recovery stages.
Today, we're talking with Angie Collins-Burke, who's had a unique experience of both being a nurse and a patient when she suffered from a stroke in 2013. Since then, she's assisted other stroke survivors as a stroke mentor and is the co-author of Just Pick Up the Peg, A Nurse's Journey from Stroke. Welcome, Angie.
Thank you for having me.
So take us back to that initial thought that you had running through your mind after you had your stroke. What did you think that your life was going to be like?
It took some time because, unfortunately, I was in and out of consciousness for several days. I had to be transported from the small community where I live to a trauma center in Toronto, which is about an hour and a half away. So for the first little while, cognitively, I wasn't able to grasp truly what had happened to me.
Wow.
And it took a long time for reality to sink in. And even though I was a nurse and I had cared for patients who had experienced a stroke, I still didn't really truly understand what was all going to be involved and all of the changes and how my life was going to be impacted until I started my journey.
So let's talk a little bit about that journey. What was it like from that moment of discovery on?
Every day seemed to be a harsh dose of reality, especially in the beginning as I started to realize more and more of the stroke's effects on me, both physically and cognitively and psychologically as well. So it was the first little while was very, very difficult, especially realizing the cognitive effects, because my stroke impacted me more cognitively than physically, and that was very difficult for me to accept. Going from being a nurse caring for patients and to where I couldn't read, where I couldn't tell time, where I couldn't understand the simplest thing, I couldn't remember what I had just been told. So each day seemed to hand me another harsh dose of reality as I began to realize just all of the impacts the stroke had had on me.
So recognizing then that that's occurring, I think that that's where some people either get too flustered or they give up or they just, like, that seems to me to be in the midst of a hell, I guess, and for lack of a better way to describe it. How do you find your way through something like that?
I went through, we'll call them peaks and valleys. I went through periods where I did work extremely hard and I was extremely determined to recover. And then, unfortunately, as part of my journey, I did spiral into a major depression and I completely lost all of my fight. I didn't care if I lived or died, and I had to be hospitalized for professional treatment. And with their help and a lot of love and support from my family and friends, I was able to get through that part of my journey and find that woman who had been so determined to recover.
Wow. I mean, in your book, you outlined how the fear of being judged and ridiculed led to this anxiety and depression and agoraphobia. And it's so interesting to me that now we're talking right here in this moment that you've been through so much. What do you think was the turning point for you, or how did you rediscover that fight in you?
I think the turning point for me was I realized it was up to me. The doctors, the therapists could give me every tool that they had in their toolbox, but ultimately it was my responsibility to use those tools. Nobody could do it for me, and if I wanted to get better and if I wanted to improve, I was the one that had to do the work.
If you're just picking up the conversation, we're talking with Angie Collins-Burke, who is a nurse who also survived a stroke. That was in 2013. So here we are 8 years later, and you've had the opportunity not only to go through some of those struggles, but to come out on this side of it. As you look back at the last 8 years, what are the – you mentioned peaks and valleys. Mm-hmm. What are the prominent peaks and or the prominent valleys that with your 2021 vision that you look back and go, oh, okay, man, I have made that through this?
Probably the depression was the darkest time in my recovery and the most challenging time, and several things led up to that. There was obviously the changes in my brain that the stroke had caused. There was the loss of my career and the loss of my identity and what do I do now, and I was left to question that. So that was probably the most challenging for me to get through, but as you said, there's been many things for me to celebrate, things that I could have never dreamt could have happened. I ended up running a 5K race and winning a bronze medal. I ended up discovering a passion for bodybuilding, and that had just started by me picking up a one-pound weight to try and get my left side strengthened up after my stroke, and I discovered I really enjoyed it, and I ended up competing as an amateur bodybuilder. I ended up with Sue Cronkright co-authoring a book to try and spread awareness and offer hope to not only stroke survivors, but anyone who's experienced or experiencing difficulties and challenges in their life, and to share some of the strategies that I learned that got me through my journey as well. Currently, Sue and I are co-authoring a blog on psychologytoday.com, again, to spread awareness about different unseen challenges that many of us face, and to spread awareness and to offer coping mechanisms and hope for those that are going through those challenges. I ended up, as mentioned, volunteering at the hospital where I had worked as a stroke mentor, and visiting stroke survivors on the stroke unit there, and again offering hope, encouragement, being a cheerleader for them. And I am currently now volunteering with the Heart and Stroke, and I'm on a committee for a project that we're working on. So I've tried as much as I can to turn my journey into a positive and to use it to help others.
It's been such a journey and such a fight for you. I'm wondering how you respond to the question from someone who says, but you look fine. That must drive you nuts.
Yeah, well, but it depends who it is and the circumstances.
Okay.
If it's somebody out in public who I probably will never encounter again in my lifetime, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, because one of the strategies, obviously, for coping is to pick your battles. Energy is very precious to me, as I get tired very easily. But if it's somebody who is in my family, a close friend, perhaps for those who are still working, a coworker, then yes, I am going to sit with them and explain some of the challenges that I still have with the neurofatigue, with the nerve pain, with the cognitive deficits, with the anxiety. And I can't promise that they're going to listen or that they're going to hear me, but I try to do my best to explain to them so they have some understanding of what life is like, and that I may look fine to them, but I still have many, many challenges that I have to deal with on a daily basis.
I love that your Twitter handle is Stroke Warrior. Tell me a little bit about that.
When I first had my stroke, I heard two different terms. Some people would refer to me as a stroke victim, and some people would refer to me as a stroke survivor. And I didn't really give it much thought in the beginning, but then I realized, wait a minute, when I first had my stroke, I agree, I was a victim. I didn't ask for this to happen, but I didn't have to remain a victim. So when people now refer to me as a stroke victim, I will immediately correct them and say, no, I'm a stroke survivor. I'm a survivor. I have fought hard. Or I am a stroke warrior. I have fought hard. This has not been an easy battle, and it isn't for anyone who's experienced a stroke. So I am not a victim. I am a warrior.
Also, the name of your book is Just Pick Up the Peg. I'm pretty sure I know why it's called that. Will you elaborate?
So my left side was affected from my stroke, and when I was in occupational therapy at one session, they were trying to get my left hand working, And I had a little board in front of me with holes drilled in it, and there was a pile of pegs on the table. And my task was to pick up one of the pegs and put it in one of the holes. And my hand was not doing what I wanted it to do. So I looked at my hand, and I started to talk to it. And as I was just pick up the peg. That's all you have to do. Just pick up the peg. So that's where the title came from.
It's so inspiring, you know, what you've been through, how you're helping other people, how you've found other things to be really passionate about in moving forward. You know, we have time for just one quick question, and it's a big question. It's not a quick question, but some of those coping strategies that you have used and continue to use with your invisible disability, what do you find is the most useful right now?
Surrounding myself with people who are positive and who accept me for who I am. Have I had friends and family walk away during my journey? I have. And yes, that hurt, but I had to understand that that was their issue, not mine. But I have had friends who have stuck by my side and gotten me through many a dark day. And I've met new friends, and some of them have similar unseen challenges that I have, so they can relate to what I'm going through. So we kind of support, and we support each other, and we encourage each other. So that's a big thing, is to keep people around me that are positive, and also to do what I've done and experiment with different activities to find those things that do bring you joy. You might find something that you never even thought of that suddenly you have a passion for and that brings you joy.
I think that's really great life advice. I know that we're speaking sort of your post-stroke and everything to do with that. But, like, surround yourself with positive people and try new things, because you'll never know if you'll enjoy them, is great, great advice and a great takeaway from Angie Collins-Burke. You can check out her book, Just Pick Up the Peg. And I envision now you talking to that hand to try and pick up that peg and put it in the hole. You can find more about her by going to her website, which is AngieCollinsBurke.com. Angie, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor.
What can we learn from the inspiring stories of World War II nurses? Well, that's coming up next.
Be prepared. Get out your journal. A world's first, you're going to want to remember this day, especially in regards to your money. We'll talk about it coming up in your Morning Buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Now, what do you do in the summer when the kids go outside and play and don't come home on time for curfew? We're solving real life problems here on The Lisa Show. That's coming up in a few minutes. But first, right here, right now, we've got your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. And oh, how I wish I could do a Donald Duck impression.
Oh.
I practiced it actually in another room before I got in here this morning because it is National Donald Duck Day. It was on this day, almost 80s, let me think, do a quick math in my head, like 83 years ago that
wow.
Donald Duck first appeared on the screen, and I was practicing my Donald Duck, and it just sounded like I had something stuck in my mouth,
so I decided
no Donald Duck impression, but you can celebrate Donald Duck Day today by watching a Donald Duck film. Maybe you could go to Disneyland. That's a way to celebrate
okay.
Donald Duck Day. As a child, I'll have to find this, dig it up out of the old photo album. There is a photo, probably I'm 5 or 6, terribly sunburned in my fair skin, and I have a shirt that says, "It's Donald Duck Day," and I'm wearing it,
adorable.
And it's adorable. This is trending over on YouTube. It's a group called Breland, partnering up with Keith Urban. If you're unfamiliar, ever since Lil Nas X and Old Town Road, and then we had The Get Up. There is a new genre of music, rap country, and
it's bound to happen.
And yeah, it let's take something here and let's take something here and we'll mash it up.
Yeah,
and we'll
kids
put
call
them together.
It the mashup.
It's called Throw It Back.
Okay.
It will be a song that you will hear ad nauseum by the end of the year.
Is it the summer song?
The song of the summer.
Well, that's another way to say it, but yes.
No, I don't think it's a song of the summer, but it is a song that you will hear a lot.
I gotta
be
ready.
Throw It Back.
Throw It Back.
And you can't really tell if it's a slow song or if it's a fast song.
Wonderful.
Or if it's a country song or if it's a rap song.
It's
so
new.
Check it out. So Throw It Back. And then finally this, in a world first, I hope you have your journal, your diary ready. The country of El Salvador, which if you don't know means the Salvador, they made Bitcoin a legal tender.
Oh.
So this is the first country in the world to make Bitcoin a legal tender.
Bold move.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, as you're going to see, continue to roll out in various countries as people accept it. Find out, first of all, what is this? And then someone else go, no, but really, what is this?
Yeah.
And then third, no, someone explain it to me again in a way that I can understand. Well, El Salvador's got it, so maybe we all follow El Salvador making it a legal tender. That is Bitcoin. That is your morning buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. In our day-to-day lives, it can be really easy to forget the sacrifices made by men and women before us so we can enjoy the lives we have today. So we want to take a moment to commemorate and celebrate the amazing people who selflessly gave their lives to protect freedom across the world, specifically the incredible war nurses who contended with a flood of wounded soldiers. Now, Ed Ruggiero is the author of Blame the Dead, a book based on World War II, backed by his long-term research in World War II. And with his extensive and intimate knowledge of the war, he joins us now to discuss a few of the heroes of the war. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's dive right into the lessons and based on all of that research that you have done. And what can we really learn from the nurses of World War II?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We are looking back over quite a long distance, but I got an email last night from a friend who is an ICU nurse in the Washington, D.C. area treating COVID-19 patients. And she said she found it strangely comforting to realize that other people had been through tough spots like this before and gotten through. She said she found it inspiring to read about medical people on the front lines in World War II and everything they had to contend with.
Oh, wow. So their experience, these nurses during that time, what did it look like for them?
So the nursing at the time was not really a highly respected profession in between the world wars. Then the military put out a call for, I want to say, 50,000 volunteer nurses, and these young women started stepping up. So imagine you're wearing a starched uniform in a hospital in, let's say, Philadelphia, and then a few months later you find yourself on the beach in North Africa or where my novel is set in Sicily.
Wow.
In the wake of the Allied invasion. And they dealt with just tremendously difficult circumstances, not only what you would expect, a flood of wounded and sometimes terribly wounded GIs of the same age, young people, but also heat and dirt and miserable conditions, and the hospital has to be ready to move on a few hours' notice to keep up with the battle lines. So these women were thrust into that. I thought it was interesting in my research finding out about, when they first joined the military, many of them, they were given these snappy dress uniforms and, some of the skirts and nice hats and all this, none of which they ever wore again once they arrived in the European theater, at least not while they were doing their duty. So it's pretty remarkable. And I'm always astounded, and this is true in my nonfiction work as well, at how young these people were. So nurses and medical professionals and doctors had this profession they brought to bear, but using it in a military context was completely new. And, they were kind of making it up as they went along.
It's a thing that, as I hear you speak about it, you know, we talk about the experience and that sort of a story, like what they received, and that all these women came forth and volunteered and sort of were part of a united movement. But there are probably individual stories that can be told out of this particular time.
Absolutely. And for my nonfiction work, I worked with a bunch of World War II veterans who were paratroopers, and two of my books are about them. And you know, after those books were published, I was sort of left with all these other stories and partial stories. And so turning to fiction in Blame the Dead allowed me to combine characters and bring up some of these things that I had learned. And one of them, as I said, that resonated with me was how young they are. And then something else is, you know, we call them the greatest generation, and perhaps deservedly so, but every veteran I've ever spoke to of that time said, look, you know, I was just a kid trying to do my job and get home in one piece.
Yeah.
So they didn't think of themselves as anything super. Although, you know, looking at what they accomplished, it's easy to see why we want to refer to them that way. But, yeah, there are individual stories, which is why a novel about this time gave me a lot of latitude to dive into personal motivations and backgrounds and how that affected them. And, you know, you have all these people who had plans for their lives that were just suddenly put on hold or interrupted. And for many of them just, you know, came to naught.
What is one of the most inspiring stories that you've heard specifically about a World War II nurse?
I was surprised to read in one of the memoirs I read that nurses actually went ashore in the invasion of North Africa in November 1942. You know, the Allies, the Americans in particular, we were kind of new at this and weren't sure what was going to work and how best to do it. And, you know, you want medical support close to the front lines because the closer you treat wounded or the more quickly you treat wounded, the better chance they have. But nurses actually went ashore with the first waves. So those famous newsreel footage of soldiers climbing down the cargo nets with all their gear on their backs and jumping into the landing craft, they were actually nurses who did that in North Africa and stayed on the beach using only what they could carry, them and the doctors, only what they could carry on their medical bags. That turned out not to be a great strategy for a way to use the medical support. So that was the last time that happened. But certainly nurses were very close to the front. I gave a talk recently about nurses who were under fire in Anzio when the U.S. invaded, when the Allies invaded the mainland of Italy. Some nurses, four nurses, were awarded the Silver Star, which is the nation's third highest award for valor in combat. Sadly, one of those women was killed. She was mortally wounded in the attack and didn't survive to receive the medal. And when I saw her picture, I looked up her picture online. Ellen Ainsworth from Glenwood City, Wisconsin, was all of 24 years old. And she's just this fresh-faced young woman in this photograph with her little curly hair sticking out from under her cap, and just looks like, you know, every young college co-ed you see. And I think, you know, what a terrible waste that was. But these nurses were right in there under fire, didn't leave their posts, and evacuated their patients, which is why they were decorated.
Wow. We're talking with Ed Ruggiero, who authored the book Blame the Dead. It is a work of fiction, but we're talking about what we can learn from World War II nurses. And I guess I would pivot to, how come we until now, until your work and maybe others of your colleagues, but in this time, how come we haven't heard as much about these nurses, about these individuals who made this sacrifice in World War II?
I think the material is out there. You know, there's a whole trove of obviously history books, but also fiction and historical fiction. And a lot of people like to get their history through storytelling like that. I'm one of those people. I read both fiction and nonfiction. I think it's just a matter of, you know, do you pay attention to that kind of stuff? Because there's so many things competing for our attention. I do think that the upcoming 75th anniversary of the end of the war in Europe in May and the end of the war in the Pacific, as you pointed out, the final surrender of Japan was signed in early September of 1945. I think these anniversaries are good times for us to sort of refresh our memories and learn again, you know, that we, as the saying goes, stand on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the nation's going, we are going through a difficult time right now. I think it's good to be reminded that we've gone through tough times before and managed to pull through. And one of the things I often say to my family is, you know, being a history nerd the way I am, I can point out that, yeah, that, well, there were tough times before. The nation's been politically divided and we've had troubles before, and we somehow managed to muddle through.
As a history nerd, your term, not mine, right?
Yeah.
You know, I feel that this is an opportunity for us to learn the lessons of the past. Is there anything about what we're experiencing specifically, other than, you know, we've been through hard times and we'll get through them as we have in the past, that we can learn from, that you wish that everyone could kind of keep in mind?
Well, you know, I recently co-authored an article with a colleague, also a former Army guy, who is now a physician and runs a hospital system out west. And we talked about, okay, well, what can we learn from wartime leadership that would be useful to people now, not just in the medical field? He was specifically thinking about his colleagues in medicine, but for anybody. And a lot of it has to do with, clarity of intent, what we're trying to accomplish here. Mm-hmm. I think of interviews with doctors and nurses now who say, well, yeah, I'm scared, but of course I would never abandon my patients. I think about, we wrote about the importance of being clear, not pretending that you know something that you don't actually know. You know, people have to trust you. And if you don't know something, just say you don't know. I noticed Governor Cuomo's briefings, you know, if he doesn't know, he just says, well, I don't know that, or, you know, I'll find out, or we'll find out. So that kind of clarity and truthfulness is essential, especially when things are tough like this. So there are lessons that we can put to use, and that's one of the benefits of reading history, is we can learn from what people have done before that worked and what people did before that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It has been compared, obviously, to a war, right? Whether it's the president or others, that, you know, we even call it the front lines, for those that are working with the pandemic right now. And you shared that experience of someone who is a nurse who has had the opportunity to read some of your work and to really find a lot of comfort in that. Is that why you wrote this, or was it to allow people to see the past and see it in our present? Or what was the reason why you decided to do all this?
So in both my fiction and nonfiction, I think that my responsibility as a storyteller, both as an historian and as a novelist, is to I want to remind people of what good things human beings are capable of. I want to remind them that, you know, there people made sacrifices so that we could have the lives that we have. People have made mistakes. And we want to avoid making those mistakes. And I want to do all that without ever glorifying war, which is the most awful human condition. And it was gratifying to me when some of the veterans I wrote about, after they read some of my nonfiction, you know, they said, okay, well, you got it. You walk the line between paying homage to what these people went through without ever trying to make it sound like something glorious. That, yeah, wouldn't that be fun? Because it's not. It's just absolutely terrible.
Well, and you've talked about the sacrifices and the pain of that, and how easily we forget. What do you think we can do now to honor this generation, those who worked on the front lines, those who came out on the other side?
Are you talking about the World War II generation?
Yeah.
Or the current? Yeah. Well, I do think these anniversaries are useful in that. And, you know, when I think about, you know, what these the people that I met, that I interviewed face to face, the veterans, you know, what they would want is they probably just want not to be forgotten. That's probably that's the worst thing. And so, you know, it doesn't require a big deal, but just to remind yourself every once in a while that sacrifices have been, you know, people made sacrifices on our behalf, people who didn't know us and people we did not know. When I take clients, so I have a business where I use history to teach leadership. I take clients to Normandy, for instance, and talk about the action there. I use a quotation from Ernie Pyle, the famous correspondent, who said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm telling this story so that you in the future will know what has been done on your behalf. So I think that's important to be reminded of those things, because, you know, nowadays we might be called upon not to make that tremendous a sacrifice, one hopes, but, you know, to have a little bit of grit and resiliency and to know that, yeah, people have been through bad stuff before and made it.
Yeah.
And then focusing on the anniversary that we'll have, the 75 years, are there particular things that you would hope to see the nation do or communities do to really outwardly, you know, give our support of this, the greatest generation, which there aren't very many left?
No, there are. In fact, I talked to my uncle yesterday, who's the last surviving member of that generation in my family, and he is a World War II vet. He joined the Navy the week after Pearl Harbor. Wow. And served. And I think You know, if you know somebody like that, if there is somebody in your neighborhood, in your town, just talk to them. And they don't necessarily want to talk about their wartime experiences. My experience in interviewing veterans is they sidestep the most difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. But they'll tell you about the time, you know, they and their buddies, you know, did something silly and laughed about it. And people just, they just don't want to be forgotten. You know, the musician, great musician and songwriter, John Prine, passed away recently. And one of his songs is called Hello in There. And it's about how old people get lonely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's an easy thing that almost everybody can do. And you don't have to reach out to World War II vets exclusively, but older folks now, and maybe especially now, might be feeling isolated. And that's a kind thing to do, to reach out to people.
Ed Ruggiero has been our guest. His fiction book is Blame the Dead. What are a couple of your nonfiction titles if people want to learn more and appreciate some of the work that you've done?
So the two of my books are nonfiction stories about the 82nd Airborne Division of World War II, the first paratroopers, first American paratroopers to go into action, combat jump about the invasion of Sicily, and the first men in about the invasion of Normandy. So in writing about Sicily and Blame the Dead and setting the story in Sicily, I'm kind of walking familiar ground because I'd done a lot of research on that campaign and been to Sicily a number of times to walk the ground. And Blame the Dead is actually the first in a series set in World War II with the same protagonist who is overburdened and over his head, but trying to do a good job.
And you can learn more all about what Ed Ruggiero is doing, including those leadership principles to be learned and maybe travel the world with Ed. You can find that online at edruggiero.com. Thanks for being with us.
Do you have your rules for summer all laid out yet? The family all on board? Well, we're going to help you get ready. That's coming up next.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. You're listening to The Lisa Show, where every week this summer we are giving away a family pass to the national parks here in the United States.
Now, exciting. It's an annual family pass. Do you know how many parks you could hit in
63,
one summer?
63. Yeah. If people go to byuradio.org, that is where you enter to win. Now, you'll go there and you'll see a banner that has Lisa Valentine Clark's face on it. It says Lisa's Adventure Club. And you click through and then you give us some information. Now, here's the deal.
I need to lean in here.
Gather around the radio sets, family. We're going back in time in the sink. There is a special word that if you enter it in, it lets us know that you listen to The Lisa Show, because you could technically, I think, just find the website and willy-nilly enter
to
win.
That's okay.
But if you want some extra entries to win, you're going to need to pay attention to this word, because you will be asked to enter it in the website, byuradio.org. And the word is
rocks. Rocks.
And if you get it really caught in the back of your throat, it's the best way to say rocks. Rocks.
It rocks.
R-O-C-K-S gets you more entries. Go to byuradio.org. You get entered to win a family national parks pass. Doesn't have to be with your family of origin. Maybe you make up your own family. That's my dad. That's my mom. That's a brother. Sure. You could do that. Nothing says you
couldn't
do
that. You just got to fit them all in the same car. I think that's the only technicality.
Yes. It's a bigger car, depending on how many people you do that to. But you'll be able to go for an entire year to any of the national parks. And as I mentioned, 63 of them, by the way, in the United States. Yeah. So go enter to win right now, byuradio.org.
Now, I want you to imagine this scenario. You've been at work, you know, you go to work and you did a, you know, good job and you... But you're a little tired, right? And when you got home from...
So I can make sure I get the scenario correctly. Am I worn out like it's a hard labor job?
Not yet.
Okay.
So you've gone to work, but you came home, but it was like one of those busy days. Oh, you know, some days allow you to come home from work and kick your feet up a little bit. Some other days... However, you come home from work and you just keep hitting the ground running, right? You grab something to eat and then you got to go to that appointment and then you've got to go pick up that one thing. And then you've got to hurry and notice that the temperatures are particularly hot outside. So you got to make sure the plants that you just planted aren't going to die. You got to water them. You got a lot on your mind.
Right.
You got to change a load of laundry, maybe run a load of dishes just to keep everything in your life running. So you find yourself moving from one activity to the next to the next.
Yeah. To be clear, in your scenario, I don't think there's a single person that's listening that's like, yeah, that time I come home from work and just kick my feet up and don't have a million things to do.
Well, I don't know. I like to imagine that maybe there's people like that
exist.
Seems wouldn't that be great?
It seems possible, but I think probably
I don't
want
to leave anyone out.
Yeah. More realistic is the
yeah. And it's one of those middle of the week days where you do get a lot done. You know, you didn't lighten your schedule like you try to on a Friday, but it's not a Monday where it's jam packed, but it's steady, right? And you're being very productive that day. You're feeling like, "Oh, I'm getting a lot done." And then you have an appointment that's at night that you don't normally have. So you're a busy parent and you've made arrangements for this. You've talked to your kids at home and you said, listen, I'm going out for a little bit. I'll be back at this time. I want you to keep an eye on each other. Mm-hmm. I want you to make dinner. Here are some ideas what you could eat. There's plenty of food. And have these things done. And when I come back, I'll see you just in a little while. Let me know if you go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Okay. And imagine this though. One of your kids says, "Oh, I want to go over to my friend's house. Is that okay?" And you say, very specifically, because you know you're a responsible parent.
Right.
You say, "Yeah, that's fine. As long as you let me know and that you're back by this time, your curfew, whatever it is." So you go off and you've had such a busy day and you go in to your appointment. You come home kind of late for you.
Did you get home past the time that you said you would be home?
It's kind of late, but it's dark, right?
Okay.
None of the lights are on. And you drive up, pull up to your house, and you expect that, you know, your kids are going to be at home, but it's dark, it's weird, and there's two strange kids in your front yard that you don't know, just kind of loitering. You roll down your window and say, "Hey, what's going on here?" And they say, "Oh, we're just waiting for your kid. He said to meet us back here. We're waiting for him." And I said, "Oh, you don't know where he is or whatever?" And I said, "Well, come on in. You can wait inside." And so you find yourself looking through an empty home. No one's home. There's no lights on. So you're turning on lights, trying to figure out what's going on. You don't know if the dog's been fed. You don't know what's happened. It's like walking into like a crime scene, right? Like you're trying to gather clues.
Okay,
like,
I can see that the pantry door is open. So
did they
someone
have
ate?
Dinner? Yeah, who's been here? How many people? Well, there's some papers and some empty cups around. Okay. And you got two strange kids you don't know in your house, too, just sitting on the couch, just hanging out. So you can't lose it and get like, what's going on?
Right.
You can't totally be yourself. So you're walking through trying to piece together what's going on. And it's getting late because let's say that you have an early job that you have to wake up for really early.
Yeah,
hypothetically.
In this completely hypothetical, there's no way this could be anyone that I know situation.
Nope.
Yeah, no. Okay. Hypothetically, you have an early job. Like what? Like 7 in the morning?
Yeah. Or earlier. Okay. And so you're starting to do the math and like, and you've been going all day.
Yeah.
So you're just tired, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do as a parent? Well, you text, right? That's why you pay for all of those phone lines so that each one of your kids can have a phone line so that you can answer these kinds of questions. That's why you pay the money every month. So you get on the phone, you start texting. Hey, where are you? Hey, what's going on? No one's home. Where is everybody? I text how many? I don't know.
Hey, John and Ryan are here, and I don't know John and Ryan. Can you come get them out of this house, please?
And you haven't had a chance to, like, have dinner. You're hungry. You're grumpy. You're tired, which is probably, as most parents know, not the best time to hunt down your kids.
Sure.
But time passes, like a half an hour, and no one has texted you back. And every parent has this moment where you just feel indignant, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I pay for phone lines for my convenience, not for my kids to ignore me from their phones. Yeah. So finally, one of my kids, Hugh, comes in. Okay, the gig's up, right? Like, mm-hmm. This is not hypothetical. This is me. And and I say, where's your sister? Where's your little sister? And he says, I don't know. Like, why should I know? I'm not my brother's keeper kind of thing, which really did not set. Which,
oh, no.
That did not go over well. And I said, what were my instructions earlier? Like, you guys need to know where each, keep an eye on each other. I texted you and said, will you make dinner for your sister? You said yes. Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, she didn't want anything. And I said, okay, and you're right.
Yeah.
That's another conversation for a different time.
Yeah, she hates eating when I'm not around.
Food.
Yeah.
And he goes, I have no idea. And I said, how do you not have any idea? And where have you been? He comes into the door. You can't make this stuff up, you guys. He's in a suit. My son doesn't even wear a suit when we go to church.
Yeah.
He doesn't wear a suit. Like, he never wears a suit. He's wearing a suit with tennis shoes. And I go, what are you doing? He goes, oh, my gosh, we're doing this funny thing. And I'm like, he wants to tell me this funny thing that he and his friends are doing where they're bothering people. You know, teenage boys.
Yeah.
And interviewing. And interviewing them in suits.
Okay.
On. It makes no sense to me, but they're laughing. They're
makes
like,
complete
this is
sense
great.
To me.
They have not a care in the world. That's my point.
Yeah.
And I say, well, but where is your sister? Because she's younger. This is my youngest. And he goes, I have no idea. Like, flippantly, which I was not happy about. And he goes, maybe she's, and starts listing off friends.
Have you thought about?
Have you thought about?
Did you check under her bed? Maybe
no
she took a nap.
Help. Well, funny you should say that, because when my kids were really little and I couldn't find them, which wasn't very often, but like they had like they would fall asleep in weird places. And I just did that. I went in every room to see, you know, she had tennis today. Maybe she was really tired. So I'm looking behind the doors in weird places, like maybe she fell asleep in her sister's room and looking everywhere, nowhere to be found. And so now I have to do the awful, shameful mom text, the text of shame that every parent knows, where you text friends, both random and close friends, hey, is Margaret there?
Peg.
Which is awful, because it's so humiliating as a parent, because now you're spreading the news that you don't know where your kid is.
Yeah.
Like, this is a shot in the dark. Now, listen. I've been on the other end of these texts.
Sure.
I've been on the other end. And there's no judgment for me, because I've been parenting long enough to know that even the best of parents who, you know.
Listen, statistically speaking, people are going to get lost for a moment. That's fine. That's how I engage.
So now I'm exhausted, tired, cranky, and I'm texting parents going, does Margaret happen to be over there? Is Margaret over there? And I'm getting the funniest texts back. And I'm also getting really like panicky, nervous with, no, do you want me to help you drive out and look for her? Yeah. Or like, no, why?
No, have you filed a missing persons report?
And then I get some great texts like, don't you hate summer? Isn't it the worst? They think they're in charge of everything. And I'm like, yeah, you get it. You get it. Let me know if you need anything kind of thing. So, you know, I finally, it ends well, right? I circle back. Before I, because I'm getting really worked up,
sure,
to all the siblings, and I have all my kids, and
23 of them,
yeah,
which takes
you
a
all
lot of-
should know where each other. You should know. Like I start parenting via text again. I don't recommend it, but we've all been there.
Sure,
where I say you should have. Why didn't you?
Yep.
Finally, after over an hour, I get a text from my son who doesn't pick up his phone. That says, oh, yeah, she's with me. I took her to a movie, late movie.
Oh.
Wait, no, no.
No?
No, stop that right there, because this is what all my friends said when I was texting back when they were like, did you find her? Did you find her? I'm not at the place where I can, oh, that's so nice. I'm still mad.
Yeah. Still now? Still mad?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, listen, I'm not going to be mad in 20 minutes, but I'm going to get over it. So here's what happened. at the end of the text, you know, my son calls me, my daughter calls me. Oh, my gosh, we're so sorry. I thought, you know, Miles told you, you know, my other son. I thought all these assumptions. Nobody told mom. I came home to an empty house for many hours past my bedtime trying to frantically find. Everyone apologized. We won't do it again. It won't happen again. But here's my point.
Yes?
This is why motherhood is exhausting.
So,
this is why when people say, hey, how are you? How's it going? A lot of parents will go, fine. Because everything's fine.
Yeah.
It wasn't a tragedy. It didn't end, you know, at the ER. It didn't end, you know, with me driving around in my pajamas around the neighborhood.
Sure.
Had it lasted 5 more minutes, that's how this story would have ended. But it is the summertime. And it is the time where the days are longer and kids are feeling this newfound freedom from not being in school. And they feel like they can just go out, go to late night movies on a school night willy-nilly. Yeah. They feel like they can go play night games outside with friends, roam the neighborhood, whatever. Mm-hmm. Wherever you live, there's this feeling. And this is my call out to parents in solidarity. We got it. We got to do something. We gotta protect ourselves. So the rules for summer, because my first thing was just yelling to an empty house to no one. Everyone's grounded. We're not doing anything fun.
We're not going anywhere ever.
Exactly. We're having no adventures. To now I've calmed down. I've been able to sleep on it. And now I'm thinking we got to have some rules for summer. And I mean some basic rules. Now, the good part about frantically texting your friends and neighbors, hey, do you know where my daughter is that it creates a coalition where we can all come together where we're like, yeah, that didn't happen to me tonight, but that happened. What are we going to do about it?
Yeah.
So the kids are uniting. Parents, this is your call. You got to call those neighbors, those friends who you would text in shame to them. Hey, do you know where my kid is? And we've got to circle together and all agree. Because if you all agree together as parents on the same block, when curfew is, when we're doing something, it creates more power. The kids are united. Are you the parents united?
Yeah, you should. You should be. Let me ask you, because I want to receive and I also want to reciprocate with your woes in the right way. I'm going to give you two options.
I need some rules for summer.
I'm holding up my hands. I've got option A and I've got option B.
Option A.
Okay. Option A, you are a warrior.
Yeah, and thank you.
And for you being here today, you know what? Honestly, you put up with so much.
Aww.
You know, no matter what, I know that sometimes you can be hard on yourself.
This isn't about me. No. This is about moms and dads across the country who do this to make their kids safe and the kids take it for granted.
Then choose option B.
Okay, option B.
All right. So you get home. House is dark.
Yeah.
Nobody's there. Nobody's responding to text messages. You have two options at that point. One, as you indicated, you pay for cell phones. Right? They should answer.
I almost shut them off.
Where is my phone app? I can see that you're over at the Dairy Queen. Why aren't you responding to me? Is one option.
Yeah.
Or we live in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week society. Call a locksmith, change the locks, and just leave your kids. Chuck a sleeping bag out on the porch.
That's funny.
A tent in the backyard and just be like, no, you're fine. You're right. You don't have the
text. It's called tough love, kids.
Yeah, but you don't get in.
Well, here's the conundrum, right? So my youngest doesn't have a phone. And here's why. You know, we do so many segments about don't give your kids cell phones, right? Mm-hmm. Don't get it until the last minute. And I think, yeah, you're right. You know, I made some mistakes. I gave my kids, the older ones, one a little bit too early. Now I've readjusted of the age. And again, that's going to be different for every family.
Sure.
No judgment. But I've made that decision. Thinking this will be better for their brain development. I didn't think about it's always another side to it. You're never going to crack the perfect code because now when I needed to get a hold of her, I couldn't.
Right. So now you're tempted.
So now I'm tempted to give her a cell phone, which is a reward for not telling me where she was and being home on curfew. So parents, we've got a hard job to do out here. So but I want to end on a positive note.
Okay.
And I want to end on like tips for rules for summer.
Okay.
And here's what I remembered, because I think I just was like, oh, it's the summer. This is how we always do. No, that was a rookie mistake.
Yep.
You got to be prepared. You got to go in. So what I'm going to do, and I wish every other parent would do this too, so that we could all be on the same page. But, you know, we got to do.
Yeah,
everyone's on their
own,
right?
You only get to rule your roost, if you will.
I'm going to circle around with the parents in the neighborhood, mm-hmm, and other friends and be like, okay, let's all decide together when curfew is.
Okay.
Because, you know, if it's like, well, Johnny's mom lets him stay out until 10:30, and, you know, and then it's their kids can use that information, other, mm-hmm, people's curfew, against you.
Sure.
You know, and then there's no wiggle room if you're like, oh, no, I talked to Johnny's mom and we all agreed at 9 o'clock, or, you know, whatever it is.
Read this text message right here from Johnny's mom. Do you see that?
Exhibit A. So circle back with the neighbors or the other friends is the first thing. The second thing is like deciding the days and the, you know, of when you can go out and when you have to be home. Because this, oh, I stay out late because it's summer and the days are longer, 7 nights a week is not going to fly.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to pick the days, and you can negotiate that with your kids, but it can't be every night.
Mm-hmm.
You're laughing at me.
Yeah.
That's the second rule.
Okay.
I
want to make sure you get out all the rules.
Okay. I'm keeping it simple. The third rule is the whole technology thing.
Uh-huh.
If you don't text mom right back when she then you're going to have to start paying for your own cell phone.
Yeah.
That's kind of tough.
Yeah. They'll pay for their own cell phone so that you can get in touch with them.
Well, then they don't get it, and then it's early curfew.
Yeah.
And it's back old school. We're 1980 parenting.
Mm.
I'm going back. It's a place to start. It's a place to start. And to all those parents of kids out for the school in summer, I say, I salute you. I am with you in solidarity. This is tough, but we need to band together because they have banded together.
Hmm. That is
my war cry.
You have established a system around summer.
Well, I'm trying to. See, this is what happens when you don't have a system.
Listen,
Richie.
Listen. I think that I think what you have done here is great.
Thank you.
And you are a warrior for the other parents that are out there. It's 92 days till school starts again.
Okay.
So let's just hold on tight.
I'm making a paper chain. Yeah. And make it a paper
do
chain.
Do it in the family room. Cut one down every day and just hold on tight. They'll get back to school before you know it.
I think we're going to make it. I think we're going to make it. I was naive for a little while that we could just,
mm-hmm,
work it out together. Mm. Now I'm doubling down again. I'm going, nope, going back. Going back to setting the rules. I've got my 3 rules. Do you have yours? It's time for a family meeting.
What I can't figure out is if the house was dark and you were tired, why wouldn't you just be like, I'm going to bed and no one's bothering me?
You have to know where your kids are before you go to sleep. You have to imagine where they all are before you can close your eyes. That's the ritual.
Okay. That is 2 different perspectives on this whole thing.
And that's what we offer. Now, coming up next, how do you know when your kids do go back to school? In how many days?
92.
If a language immersion program might be right for them.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. We'll talk about it coming up next.
Listening to Richie T
and Lisa Valentine Clark.
It's the Lisa Show.
Are the teenage years giving you trouble as a parent? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to learn why a family value culture may just be the thing you need to try.
Coming up in your morning buzz, we're talking about today's Google Doodle. And I'm going to give you a clue, because you're probably going to go seek it out, and you're going to be like, well, who is that? Here's the clue. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay.
I'll do it again in case you missed it.
Yeah, yeah.
The clue for today's Google Doodle Morning Buzz discussion. That one wasn't as good. Give me one more. There we go. That's coming up in 15 minutes.
Learning another language is hard, but imagine doing it when you're still trying to get a good handle on your first language and while you're being introduced to the world of education. Language immersion programs are becoming more and more common and more intensive, but what exactly are they? Well, here to tell us more is Stacy Lyon, an administrator, teacher, and trainer who spent years working in language immersion programs to answer these questions. Welcome to the show, Stacy. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So at the very basic, when people say, oh, yeah, my child's in a language immersion program, or we're considering a language immersion program, what does that mean?
Well, if you're in Utah, it means basically one thing, because there's a Utah model for language immersion. And there are multiple models for language immersion, which relate to how much time you actually spend learning the language that you're that we call the target language, and English. So, for example, in Utah, our model is a 50-50 model. So that means that the students spend 50% of their instructional time in English and 50% in Chinese.
And what is it typically across the country?
The 50-50 model, or the Utah model, as it's become called, tends to be more common. There are models that are 80-20, or models that start at 100 and then decrease, or start with 50-50 and increase to 90-10 and 80-20. Those are harder to measure and implement. So in Utah, because this is funded by the legislature, that's the model that we use.
And are there different kinds of programs for different languages? Is it language specific, or is it specific to an education style?
So again, using our example here in Utah, with our model, it's the same for any language that you're learning that's part of the state dual language immersion program. So we have six languages, Spanish, French, Chinese, Portuguese, Russian, German, and we all use the same model implementing. Most of our programs begin at first grade. I think Spanish begins at kindergarten or has in the past, but our shortened kindergarten day in Utah doesn't leave a lot of time for splitting in half, a couple of hours for language.
Sure.
But yeah, so it's 50-50 across all the languages that we learn here. So
How do students get involved in this? Is it testing to get in? Is it an additional fee within the school system, or how do students select or get selected?
That's a great question. How it works, because this is, like I said, a state program, and so it's open. It's a general education program, so that means there's no special requirements or qualifications to participate. The way it's implemented in most districts is that there's a lottery that parents enter in January, typically, depending upon the district. And you sign up, and if your name gets selected, then you get to be in the program. And that usually happens so people would sign up for that in their kindergarten year for their entering first grade, which is when the program begins.
So when it's off and running, what does that look like? What is the typical day or life of that student's education for that day look like?
Okay, so it changes as you go through the grade levels, but again, the standard is 50-50, 50% of your days in the language classroom and 50% is in the English classroom. So there are two separate classrooms. So each child in immersion has two teachers, an English teacher and the language teacher. And in the early grades, first through third, the students receive all of their what we call content instruction, which means math, science, social studies in the target language, so in Chinese, as well as Chinese literacy and language itself. And in the English classroom, they're focusing on English literacy. And then that teacher also reinforces those other subject areas for 10 minutes a day, something like that.
And it's typically, I think, when we look at programs like this, and certainly you've been highlighting the ones in Utah, because it seems like it is leading the way, or a lot of different states are looking at what they're doing there to how to implement it nationally. What is it about the age of starting that program in the first grade? What does that have to do with predicting future success with the language?
Well, kids' brains are wired for language. You know, at the very first 5, 6, 7 years of their life, that's when our brains are geared for learning language the most quickly and absorbing it. So that's one reason, because you're able to cover a lot more ground very quickly and get their brains flipped into that language. Gives them, because in our program, for example, in Utah, we go all the way through 12th grade. And so by the time they finish that pathway, the hope is that they're at an advanced level, which is equivalent to, you know, a college degree level, mm-hmm. you know, third or fourth year of college study level. So it gives them that opportunity to also develop a breadth of language beyond just social language that typically you might, most people remember from like high school. If you took a language, you know, you can remember the songs and maybe, you know, a couple of things.
Right.
But proficiency in actually using the language in academic settings, as well as just all sorts of contexts, is what the advantages of starting then, because then you're bringing in all these other subject areas where they can be conversant.
If you're just dropping into the conversation, we're talking with Stacy Lyon about dual immersion programs. First of all, what they are, and then we've sort of evolved into how they work here in the state of Utah and certainly across the nation. As far as assessing or kind of research into this, I know that like when people say, mm-hmm. you know, our student will take piano lessons and that opens up a certain part of the brain and makes them a better student as far as that goes. Does language and this dual immersion play into some of those things as well?
Most certainly does. There have been two studies done through the University of Utah that have used data from our program, our students' assessments you know, and originally many parents at the beginning thought, oh, this is going to hold my child back if they're going to be slower in their other subjects or in English. And what these studies have shown is that the students in dual language immersion perform as well as, and in many, many cases, most of the time, beyond students who are not in immersion.
So what are some of the reasons why this kind of program might not be good for parents or particular students?
I think initially the first month is always a transition for, you know, for students stepping into language. You know, you can't separate language and culture. And so I oversee Chinese. That's a culture that is a little further away from Western culture, and it takes time to adjust to teachers, teaching styles, personalities, and the culture of, in the classroom that might be a little bit different. Most of the time, we don't run into a lot, but there are situations where students might feel a little bit too much pressure. However, just trying to make the adjustment back and forth. But the research shows is that it's actually learning another language is the quickest way to get through achievement gaps that we have with students, because you're actually getting an extra dose of all of those literacy pieces. It's the same principles. And so there's tons of research about that.
How long have dual immersion programs been around? It seems almost like a thing like charter schools to me, where it didn't exist and then all of a sudden it was everywhere.
Well, actually a long time. You know, I don't know if you're talking about just the U.S., but Canada for, you know, a long time has had French immersion as part of their system. Hmm. In the U.S., I would say it's probably been 30 years that the whole bilingual education movement is different than immersion, but sort of transitioned to immersion with Chinese. I can speak to Chinese most specifically. It's been probably about 15 years that Chinese sort of came onto the stage with immersion, and I think that just came at a time as our country started realizing the need for global, you know, being global citizens and global awareness, and that, you know, as we have had the internet open up the world to everybody, people have begun to understand the significance and importance of being able to communicate with more than just the people in our neighborhood that might speak the same language.
Well, certainly worldwide, this is an old idea, right? They have, have taught many different languages. And in America, it's kind of a new idea.
We're like, have you guys heard of this?
And everyone else is like, we're in a different language. And they're like, yeah, we know. We get it.
Right. If I can just kind of behind.
Yeah. If I can just pull back the curtain a little bit, my daughter, who just graduated from high school, was the first class that did a French immersion program in our particular school district, and my subsequent children have done it, and it's been a great success for our family. I think that there, for a lot of people, especially nationwide, it's still a little bit of a foreign idea, or there's still, you know, maybe some healthy skepticism about it, and sort of the opportunities that they might not think about that might be associated with. I'd love to get your personal perspective of why you think it's important that children learn these language skills, especially so early on, and maybe not wait until they're in high school or college. What do you think personally is the benefit, you know, out of all the different ones that we've talked about that rises to the top?
Well, I think, just as I mentioned a minute ago, I think it's a different world now than it was 15 years ago or 10 years ago or even 5 years ago in terms of what our kids are able to access and who they're able to interact with. And I think, number one, you have a richer life experience as you learn to see the world through other people's eyes. And the language is the tool that really gets you there. You can't separate language and culture. And I think it just expands people's vision. I think just it's exciting to see among our students their excitement for and passion for communicating with people. You know, just quick example. This, you know, 2 years ago, I think it was fall of 2019, when we had the tourist bus accident of people from China. Mm-hmm. And near that time, we also had a car accident where none of the policemen with Chinese tourists, where none of the policemen, they couldn't find anybody to speak to them. Mm. They remembered an officer's son was in Chinese immersion and called up the sixth grade son, and he ended up interpreting and helping them resolve the whole situation.
Oh, wow.
You know, you want to, you know, so you just never know.
Yeah.
I mean, what an awesome experience for everybody involved there.
Just sort of a question in closing. If we live in a part of the country, as we're listening to this and go, yeah, you know what, this is something that I really wish that my local school board or school mm-hmm. offered, or maybe even a grander region, how can we start to bring these kind of dual immersion programs to our area?
Well, first of all, gather your stakeholders, gather your people that are passionate about it. Across the country, we collaborate with each other very closely. And so wherever you are, I mean, lots of people come to us here because we are the largest program in the country. Hmm. There's only one other state that has a state program. I say reach out to us. We can start conversations and then know where to help direct you, because there are plenty of people that are doing the same thing and trying to get programs going in their communities, and we can hook you up.
That's very generous.
Where is the best place to reach out to you guys?
We have a website, utahdli.org, or me personally, utahchinesedli.org. You send an email there, and yeah.
Stacy Lyon, thank you for being here with us to talk about language immersion programs as we, you know, seek to be able to not only to spread this this knowledge, this learning of mm-hmm. these various languages, but like you said, you never know when it will come into such great importance. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
What is a family culture, and how can it really help your family establish values? That's coming up next.
The Google Doodle is the topic of discussion. Think about it. How does that feel in your heart? we'll discuss coming up in your Morning Buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Are you looking to create a better bond with your family? Well, in 20 minutes, we're talking about how you can plan a successful family outing. We've got real tips for you. But first, it's time for your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online, things that folks are talking about. This first one, Rick and Morty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, lock up your Szechuan sauce. There's going to be a Rick and Morty movie, producers say. So look forward to that coming to the theaters.
Great
idea.
Now
that we have theaters again.
Yeah.
Now, if I say Rick and Morty and you don't have any idea, just move along.
You're not going to suggest that they go down that hole that
I feel like with the seasons that are available, okay, if you haven't found your way to Rick and Morty, it's not saying that it's not great or
that it's terrible.
Or anything like that. It's just like it just may not be a thing for you. You know what is for you?
What?
How many Earls do you have in your life? Think of Earls that you know. Do you know any Earls?
I don't think I do.
Yeah. I know an Earl. Today is his day. It's National Earl Day. So
great.
I celebrate you, Earl C. Cutler.
Aww.
He taught me the self-affirmations in the mirror at a pivotal time in my life. He said,
really?
You know what you do. And he used his name. He said, Earl C. Cutler, you handsome devil, you. He said, that's what you need to start every day. Why don't you do that? So
nice.
I celebrate you, Earl,
well,
on this,
like
the National
Earls
Day
might
of
be,
Earls.
Yeah, some special guys.
If you need a famous Earl to celebrate, how about Earl Warren, Earl Scruggs, Earl Curly Lumbau? Those are just three Earls that you could celebrate. Okay. You probably likely are thinking of that special Earl in your life and celebrate that person today as it is National Earl Day. And finally, this, the Google Doodle.
Yes.
Shirley Temple is who the Google Doodle is.
Oh!
Thus, when I gave you the little clue of, it's Lollipop.
Aww.
Shirley Temple, born in 1928, was encouraged by her mom at a young age to dance, to sing, and to act when she was just barely 3 years old. She got her first opportunity to do so. 2 years later, achieved international fame for her performance in the movie Bright Eyes, a movie that featured her singing the soon-to-be hit The Good Ship Lollipop. Now, she went on to continue to act, did more than 40 movies before the age of 12.
That's amazing.
Singing and tap dancing. She continued to make movies into her late teens. And then you think, well, what happened? America did not accept that Shirley Temple grew up.
Yeah,
they would not accept that
she was a
woman. So what she did, she returned to the spotlight after marrying businessman Charles Black and became, of course, Shirley Temple Black, where she became a fundraiser interested in politics. She ran for Congress unsuccessfully in 1967, was appointed to be a delegate to the United Nations by Richard Nixon, go on to serve as the U.S. ambassador to Ghana, President Gerald Ford's chief of protocol, and President George H.W. Bush's ambassador to Czechoslovakia. We salute you.
That's amazing.
Not only the Earls, but Shirley Temple. The Google Doodle on this day. That is your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. When I think about the amusing times in parenting, I don't think that I'm alone when I think, oh, it's probably those teenagers.
Yeah.
Right? Parenting teenagers, amusing.
Yeah, I mean, but when the kids are so cute and they're so little and there's, you know, there's all that time too.
Yeah, well, adolescence, though, is this marked time when kids start exploring their sense of self-identity, their purpose. There's a lot of confidence and then a lot of insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an interesting time. And a world full of instant messages and Insta-fame that they are experiencing right now, how can we help our kids find their purpose without just getting lost, especially when those purposes seem to be contradictory, right?
Ooh, yeah.
Like they're given a lot of different messages from a lot of different sources. Well, parenting experts Kent and Amy Bowler are joining us for this conversation. We want to have a conversation around this idea about using a family value culture to help our adolescents, our teens, find a sense of purpose. Welcome, Kent and Amy. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
Yep, love it.
So the big broad question, I think we'll toss this to you, Kent. What is a family value culture?
A family value culture. That's easy. That's where we have a culture where our family is first and foremost, where we value our family. In our family, we have a saying, our best family. And that's how we view it. Our family is the most important thing. And we love our family so much. And our family is the best. That's better than any other family. I'm sorry.
It's like a rah-rah, go-go. Encouraging. And so tell us how you have created that. Amy, let's start with you.
Yeah, that's it. It's a great question because it's not an overnight thing, but there are super simple things. Part of it is talking about it, having time together, talking about it, but us as the parents creating this vision for what we want, seeing the future, even when our kids were young or when they start to become teenagers. Okay, what do we really want it to look like? And then creating that, because it's one thing to say, well, we want to do this. But I think a lot of times as parents, we're so busy and we don't take the time to stop and say, well, we're not happy with what's going on. What is it that we want to create in our family? And then start talking with our children about it and putting in place rituals, traditions, and just fun things that you do that make that culture happen.
I just hear people going, oh, what a great idea. But it's too late for me, right? Like, I should have started this when the kids were born, when they were little. And now things have gotten out of control. I can say, you know, that I want this because I know I don't have it. So if you're in the middle of, you know, kind of the mess of family life and stress, how do you start one? Kent, what's your perspective?
Well, it's never too late. In fact, it's funny because our teenage son, who is older, that's his favorite saying, it's never too late. And so from the words of a teenager, it's never too late. And what we can do to start that is do something fun.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that.
The kids always love doing things that are fun. And so one of the things that is part of our family culture is doing a monthly fun activity. And you can do more frequent than that if you want to, right? But where we... like yesterday, we spent a day together and it was super fun. We didn't spend a whole lot of money. We spent some money, but it was a fun day that we spent together. And do that just to kick off your creating this family culture. We do fun things together on a regular basis. That's part of our culture now. We spend time together. And when that's a fun activity that we do together, they're not going to say no to that.
And fun to them, because I think sometimes to us, well, this will be fun if we do the weeds.
Yeah, we'll make it fun. I can make it fun.
That's right. I mean, but we can. And as the culture grows and as you strengthen that family culture, then you can make those kinds of work things fun. But in the beginning, when you're really trying to create something that you feel is missing, do start with ask them what a fun family activity would be.
Then do you reinforce it too? Aren't we having fun? Isn't this a fun thing?
With that tone of voice, that's perfect.
Yeah. Totally. And you know, I mean, really take pictures, talk about it, talk about it with your friends, talk about it later. Do you remember when we went here? Wasn't that cool? I loved that.
Well, it's funny that you bring that up, Richie, because yesterday as we were going through our day, the kids themselves several times throughout the day said that this is a fun day. We were having so much fun. It's so good. And we said, yes, we had so much fun. At the end of the day, we brought it up. Oh, that was a great day. Yes, that was a great day. Absolutely.
Yeah. You creating that kind of conversation with your friends to help enforce them in their own families, and then it reinforces what you're doing in your family is kind of that. It seems that you have to be really like aware of it, aware of how you're talking about your family. I'm wondering, Amy, when you are talking to other families, what are the sort of questions that you get about your family that you have found that people are the most curious about?
People are curious about specific things that we do that bring us strength. People ask us what we do as a couple to have a strong family. Also, what we do on a daily basis. What are the specific little things that you do? Because I think it's kind of easy to say, well, yeah, that sounds really great. But in the nitty gritty, you know, when it gets down to it, what are you doing when you wake up in the morning that strengthens your family? What are you doing for meals? What are you doing? Just those little habits that create what our family is. And that's what I find people are. And with the pandemic stuff, the struggles of families being kind of stuck together for so long, mm-hmm. and just this disruption, we've had to kind of look outside the box. And that's kind of what teenagehood is about. It's like all of a sudden our kids change and now they're different and they want to be with their friends more. And we have to be careful that we're not like becoming so sheltering or so demanding of our teenagers. It's a natural thing that they go out and want to be more independent. We want to encourage that, not squelch that. But when you have that strong family culture, both things can happen.
We're visiting with Kent and Amy Bowler about creating family value culture. And specifically, as you kind of queued up the idea of talking about our early, mid, and late teenage mm-hmm. kids, it's great if the kids are like, yes, I value the family and our culture, and I'd love to be able to participate in that. But there are parents likely that are listening to this that are like, my kid would never be on board for that. It is the time that they want to spend with their friends. They have zero interest in being with us. How, if we find ourselves in those kind of situations, how can we not lose hope about this family culture, or what can we do different than maybe what we're doing currently?
You know, the truth is that every child looks up to their parents. And yes, there is a phase where we're teenagers, where we go through this rebellion and we want to pretend like we're all that and that we can be independent and are independent and go off and be with our friends. But the truth remains that every single one of us want that love and validation from our parents. Yeah. That's a given. And if we remember that as parents, then we can push through that initial kickback or pushback where the kids are saying, no, I'm doing my own thing. I'm hanging out with my friends. If we hang on to that truth and remember that, we can continue pushing forward and creating that culture and creating those rituals and events and things that we do where now they are in it and a part of it and they love it and are so thankful to be in it because they feel from us that love and they know that we cherish them and that we see them, that we see their goodness and their greatness. And that's more fulfilling than anything they're ever going to get anywhere else.
I like this idea of that, you know, everyone's invited to this club and that's our family, yeah. You know, that everyone has an important role to play. And I hear you saying, you know, this is in our rituals and our events and talking about it and doing fun things. And that's what creates this kind of culture. I'm also curious as if you have a family mantra or if you have like a motto or some families have a mission statement or something like that. Do you find that is helpful or is that? Or is that just something that you can really create?
Oh, yeah, you totally can. We have our mission statement up in our kitchen, and it has something about kicking butt. And, you know, it's a little bit playful, fun, but also our really strong core values. But then we have our mantra which Kent mentioned before, the best family, which is just kind of a shortened version and something that people can latch onto. Yeah. So good. So powerful. It's that vision, creating kind of like a spiritual creation. What is it that you want it to be? Talk about that. Create that. There's another activity that we do to teach parents how to do this. We have them make like it's like a silhouette outline of a family, mm-hmm. and then just brainstorm words. What are attributes that we want in our family? Like fun, inclusive, strong, patient, understanding, you know, just throw it out there. What do we want our family to be?
Has your family culture changed as your kids have gotten older and they're entering that new phase of life and even the phase where they leave home?
Sure. There are things that change. There are some of those rituals that might change. but the core of who we are hasn't changed. So some of the things that have changed as kids have left the home, one of the things that we do now as a family ritual is we have a family group me. And so we share pictures from, not everybody's in the same town, and we all share pictures of what's happening in our respective families as our kids have kids. And we share those pictures on GroupMe, and it keeps everybody pulled together. We have a family Marco Polo where we send Marco Polos back and forth to each other, and we stay connected with each other that way. And so there, some of the tools that we're using to stay connected have changed, but we are still connected, and we still have that core strength in our family culture.
You know, we talk about this family culture and, you know, knowing our kind of core values. And I guess this would go back to almost the beginning of this conversation, which is, what if we maybe don't know? Or we haven't identified, said them out loud, or been able to write them down, what our family's core values are. Is there a practice or an exercise that can help us get to the root of who we are as a family?
Yeah, the looking for what are your values. For us, it's going to the scriptures, looking to God, praying, finding, you know, where is your core source of where you find truth? And look there first, because you're going to find some direction about what matters, and then have it be uniquely yours, because really every family is so different. Every individual is different, but just as parents, you're going to want to create something that's different. I think of one of our daughters is newly engaged, and she and her fiance are already talking about what is it that they want their family to be. And ideally that is what you want to do, but we can start at any time and just say, what is it that we want? And it's okay that we don't know everything right now. Mm-hmm. Let's just think one thing that we'd like our family to be.
It's such great advice. And unfortunately, we're wrapping up our time with you. We have about a minute left. In that time, I think it would be worth it just to talk about the benefits of having a family value culture.
Oh, the benefits are so fantastic. When we have that strong family value culture, then our home is a sanctuary. It becomes a safe place. It's where our children know that regardless of the mistakes that they make, or the problems that they encounter as they go through their life and their things, that always, always, home is a safe place where they feel loved, where they feel trusted, where they know who they are, where they see and feel their greatness, and are able to stand and be counted to do what they need to do, because our family culture is so strong that it has created for them that foundation that is sure and solid.
And if you feel like it's too late, Kent and Amy Bowler would let you know it's never
late.
It's not too late.
Don't say that.
They have a podcast series called Revolutionary Families, Parenting Heroes. If you'd like to listen to more of their parenting advice, you can go to revolutionaryfamilies.com or follow them on Facebook at Revolutionary Fam. Kent and Amy, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
You know, when we talk about families, I can't help but think about family memories that you can create by taking a road trip, right? By getting everybody into the car.
The station wagon with wood on the side. Yeah.
Well, in our day, and now it's the sleek minivan with the doors that open and close automatically.
There's a vacuum in the back? There's a vacuum back here?
And so it makes it easier than ever to go on an adventure. And here on The Lisa Show, we are doing Lisa's Adventure Club. So we're highlighting all these different places that you can go throughout the summer and having a contest that you can enter for a chance to win a national annual parks pass. How many parks?
There are 63 at last count, and I counted them this morning, so unless we've added
every
more.
Every morning before the show, Richie comes in and counts them.
I do them
he
in
loves
alphabetical
them all
order.
Equally. Yeah.
Acadia. If you go to BYUradio.org and look for the Lisa's Adventure Club banner, click on that, enter to win right there. You can do it that way. You can also go BYUradio.org/adventure and get right to where you need to do. Now, you can do things like entering your name, phone number, and email. That's the way you just generally enter.
You can share it with a friend.
Right. If you do it through our mechanics where you share it on your social media, more entries.
So do that. Share it on your social media. Spread the love.
And then if you know the special secret word of the week, and you enter said word into the place where it says enter the secret word, you can get even more entries. That lets us know that you're listening. And the word is
rocks.
R-O-C-K-S. That is the word rocks. You got to put that in. Get more entries to win. We will be giving away one of those annual National Parks passes this very week. And those that enter to win, you are then qualified to try and win the $500 Visa card that we'll give away at the end of the summer.
So exciting.
It's BYURadio.org. It's Lisa's Adventure Club.
Now, coming up, we're going to learn how to plan a family outing that everyone will enjoy.
You are listening to The Lisa Show. I enjoy. You are listening to The Lisa Show.
Now that the kids are out for summer break, everyone is looking for fun and creative ways to spend time together as a family. Whether it's a walk in the park or a road trip or going out to get ice cream, these family fandangos are a great way to strengthen your bond with everybody. It's an opportunity, right, for us to become a little bit closer. Today we're joined by Vanessa Quigley, co-founder of Chatbook Company, close friend of The Lisa Show. She's here to share her tips on the importance of these kinds of family outings and where to begin if you're like, ooh, already overwhelmed by the beginning of the summer. Welcome, Vanessa. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Okay, so I think this is a funny idea when you're like, hey, let's create some family fandangos. is this an outing? What is this?
Okay, I love that you're using the word fandango. That is my word. So it is just anytime you leave your house with your family. When we had a young family and not a lot of money, we gave it this funny name. We called it a family fandango. And it's funny how a funny name like that can make even the most ordinary outing feel special. And my little kids thought it was like amazing. We're going on a fandango. Family fandango. So it elevated just the like a trip to the library.
Okay.
Another way to elevate even the tiniest outing for us has always been music. My kids all adore music, so letting the kids pick a playlist, their own playlist, and program the music, it was always a huge privilege to be in charge of the music, and we would take turns each way. And then every outing in the Quigley family involves a treat of some sort, and so allowing another kid to pick the treat, getting the kids involved. But, a fandango can be anything like going to get new books from the library. That was always a summer staple in our family, were library outings. Or just packing up your dinner and driving somewhere to eat other than your house. Because in the summer, for me, it's all about just getting out of the house. So the other night, we were getting ready to have dinner, and we decided to just pack it up real fast. Luckily, we live 10 minutes from the most gorgeous canyon in Utah. Drove up the canyon. My daughter brought her guitar. We had dinner. She played music. It was beautiful. And honestly, it was made me so happy to see how many other families had that same idea. There were families everywhere.
Was this idea of a fandango something that you felt like was important as you have your family? Or were you raised on a fandango?
No, I'm the oldest of 12, so we didn't actually go anywhere, hardly ever. So maybe that's why this was such a big deal to me. I'm like, oh, we got to do fun outings. But you know what? I have 7 kids, and so it's not easy. And it can be really expensive if you think every outing needs to be to an amusement park, on a vacation. It doesn't need to cost any money, but give it a fun name and make some fun traditions. And then photograph it all. You know, I'm always about taking the photos. As we've looked through our photos, even the tiniest, smallest, least expensive outing feels more special when you've got a photo of it and you can look back on those memories.
How often do you do this?
Okay, the goal is to do it once a week, an official fandango once a week. But like I said, they vary. Now that it's summer, we try to plan one trip as a family, like a vacation. And that's like a big fandango. And to make those special, I like to write up itineraries. I used to make binders for my kids when I had a bunch of little kids. For every trip we took, there was a binder. It had an itinerary. It had like history about the places we were going. It had journaling pages. It had little activity pages for the kids to play to do when they were driving in the car. So that is like one extreme of like an ultimate Fandango. But eating our meals out, going for a hike. I love hiking in the summer, just getting outside. Being outside feels like you're closer to God. I feel closer to my kids. You get a new perspective. You get exercise. That counts as a Fandango, my book.
What do you do to make something like a Fandango fun for kids of lots of different ages? You know, not just little kids, but maybe when the kids get a little bit older.
I let them in on the planning. So in, like I said, I like to hike in the summer. So I let the kids pick the hikes ahead of time. Although I do have to help my youngest because he's a very vocal non-hiker.
I have vocal non-hiker. That's such a great way to put it.
But older kids, they love planning. They love to pick a new restaurant to go try. Or I heard that the drive-in movies are starting to open up again. And my daughter, she suggested that as an outing. That is like the perfect Fandango. Bring a bunch of treats and take the truck and sit in the truck bed and watch a movie. That sounds dreamy.
Yeah, that does sound dreamy.
Being able to do this with, as you mentioned, seven schedules of your kids and then you and your spouse. And Lisa's got like 35 kids and her family. How do you coordinate that with so many moving pieces and parts?
Well, I mean, in an ideal world, all of my kids and my husband are together every time we go out, but that just doesn't happen anymore. And, you know, and that was actually a sad day when I had to accept the fact that it's okay if not everyone is together for every outing. And so now I just take who's there. You know, we like to get something scheduled where we know at least everyone's going to be together, but don't let that stop you. Yeah. I only have three kids in the house this summer, honestly.
Oh, wow.
On a daily basis. And so the three of us are going to go, and even if Dad can't go, he actually threw his back out playing tennis, so he's not going to be hiking for a while. It's okay. You can still make family memories with part of your family. It's all how you look at it.
That youngest kid is like, I'll stay here and take care of Dad. You guys go hike. I'm really worried about him. I'll stay here.
If you're just jumping in on the conversation, we're talking about how we can have family outings this summer and how it will strengthen our family bonds in doing such. With Vanessa Quigley, who is a mother of seven and a business owner, a very busy woman herself. I love to hear the sort of cross-generational connections that you're making with these family Fandangos of thinking about, you know, what you did in your childhood with your parents and now what you are trying to incorporate or do with your own children and hopefully what they, you know, continue on. It seems like such a great way to connect that way. Do you ever do any sort of family outings that turn into, you know, an opportunity to share stories cross-generationally?
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay, one of my favorite things to do, especially if we're in the car or last time we went camping when I had all my kids in the tent, we actually made this game at Chatbooks. It's called This Is Us, and they are cards kind of like tabletop cards. You know what those are? They're like little conversation prompts. Mm-hmm. You can also print them off the internet, but just questions to get the kids talking. Reminiscing on stories or sharing things about themselves that maybe we didn't know. And those are my favorite conversations. In fact, I just went on a trip with my dad and my mom took me and my sisters on a little weekend getaway. And I brought a book that had all kinds of prompts and kind of deeper questions like, when do you feel like you fit in the most? Or what person has inspired you the most? Or what were the turning points in your life? Mm-hmm. And even amongst these sisters of mine who I've known my entire life, I learned new things. I felt connections were stronger. So it's sometimes we can go to the beach and we can just put our music on and we just tune things out. No one talks to each other. And you know what? That's okay too. But I think as a parent, if you are actively looking for times to have important conversations, not hard conversations, just discovery conversations or reminisce about things in the past or share stories from your family or family history. Those connections are so important. And I think that's when you feel the strongest and closest to each other.
I'm reading one of these tabletop prompts right now, kids. What is something that you have done that you've never told your mom or dad about that we should know? Just silence.
Yeah. Actually, when you get older, it's easier to share those things.
I was going to say
some things on our trip that were a little scandalous.
A little time and distance, really?
Yeah. What are my parents going to do about it now? They just, we all got a good laugh.
I don't live in your house anymore.
Give us an example of a couple of these tabletop questions, the ones that you think are your favorite as a mom.
I love getting to know the inner life of my kids. You know, I observe a lot as a mom of what they're doing, but like delving into something like, when was the last time you felt left out of something, you know? And again, I'm also about talking about the hard stuff. I like to have my kids share what's hard and challenging in their life and sharing that with a family. That was actually one of the questions when I was with my sisters, and it really revealed some really interesting and new things about all of us as we shared our take on that. But also fun things like what movie character do you most, that you think you're most like?
Oh,
or
cool.
What would be the theme song of your life if you had to pick one song? You know, just fun stuff.
I love it. Such a great way to like spark conversations and things like that. And I appreciate that you're sharing this, that you don't just do this with your kids, but that you were doing it with your family of origin, with your sisters. I was thinking that this would be a really great way to get to know friends, you know, that instead of just coming, you know, over, a lot of us are feeling a little bit awkward from not socializing. We're desperate for connection, and we want to get to know our friends sort of in a different way. It's interesting how these ideas for family outings or for conversation starters have just so much application across different social circles.
Yeah. In fact, there's a book, I'll tell you, and my friend Laura Tremaine wrote a book called Share Your Stuff, I'll Go First. It's 10 questions to take your friendships to the next level. I love this book. I recommend it as you're trying to, like you said, delve back into social situations and rekindling some of those friendships. But I think it also applies to our most important relationships with our family members. So that might be something good to check out.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I fully comprehend the Fandango before we let this go. It's the building excitement. We're trying to do it once a week. It's getting buy-in. Oftentimes it's our kids are helping plan. Is there a Fandango song that the Quigley family sings?
Oh,
is there a
motto
crest,
or something?
A flag,
yeah.
a motto?
Involved
an
out,
is it an outfit?
You know what? We have in the past, had coordinating outfits for like our bigger Fandangos. We have experimented with family songs, but anything I come up with, my kids nix. We do have something we call the huggle. It's a cross of a huddle of hugs called the huggle. I like to end every Fandango with a huggle, 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 huggle. As we all crash in on each other, hugging each other.
That's adorable.
But yeah, all those things, all those sound like great ideas. But I will say a lot of the family Fandango is building up the anticipation and the excitement. Hmm. In the summer, put it on your calendar. Make sure the kids have something to look forward to. Build up the anticipation by getting them involved. Yeah, and come up with a family song. I want to hear it.
Now I
love that.
I want to get your permission because Fandango, certainly trademarked by the Quigley family. Don't tread there.
Yeah, don't steal theirs.
I'm thinking about for the Stedman family, a hootenanny.
Can I get
permission for
yes.
It's a family hootenanny?
Hootenanny's a great word, too.
Hootenanny. And you know what? I officially give permission for everyone to have a Fandango.
Oh.
It is too good of a word to keep to myself. So have a Fandango, have a hootenanny, have whatever you want. Just have fun.
Now, we don't want to steal all of your ideas, but a little bit we do. What do you have on the calendar that everyone's getting excited for the summer in way
okay,
of your Fandangos? Share it with us.
The first thing that comes to my mind is our big one. We try to do one big thing a summer, and my husband just booked a, what do you call those silver campers? They look like a little bullet.
Oh, the Airstream?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He booked an Airstream, and we're going to Montana. And that is going to be interesting. He gave us the little virtual tour of where everyone's going to be sleeping. And my kids are like, uh-huh. Okay.
Is it going to be tight? Is this what I'm reading into?
It's going to be a little tight. But you know what? There's going to be all kinds of good family connections. So
it's a Fandango.
Yeah, we're sleeping.
Fandango.
We're sleeping in a huggle because apparently that's going to go down. Vanessa Quigley, a close friend of the show, founder of Chatbooks and author of The Fandango. the Family Fandango. Thank you for sharing with us what has made your family to be successful and what you have figured out. And best of luck as a family of nine fits into the Airstream this summer in Montana.
Thank you so much. All right.
I love the idea of, you know, earlier in the show, and if you didn't listen, you can go back to the Lisa show. You can find it on
wherever you get podcasts.
Yeah.
It's Spotify, Apple Podcasts,
kind of
Google, TuneIn, Stitcher.
And we talked about summer being this time where you sort of unleash your kids into the neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. And they're coming and going and staying up late, and it's fun and exciting, but it's also nerve-wracking. If you have those family fandangos, it really brings everybody together in a way that where you know where everyone is.
Well, at least
you don't
one,
lose them.
At least one time a week, you'll know where everybody is.
Exactly.
If you plan one of those.
Peace of mind. Peace of mind.
I love the idea and the anticipation that's built around it, making an event out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And something that she said that we sort of walked right by, but that I know is hard for a lot of parents is the if not all the kids can make it, the feeling guilty by doing it anyway.
If you just grab one kid or
you just
two,
have
and if
to.
Is that
yeah.
enough?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just being able to do it. I will share our I didn't realize that we do a family fandango, but I guess we do. In the summer, mm-hmm. we have this tradition in the Clark family since the kids were little. So mm-hmm. it's been decades now, I think. Well, maybe a decade or so, where the kids don't know when it's coming, but one night in the summer, I will just say, ice cream for dinner.
Yes.
And we go to an ice cream parlor, and they can order whatever they want, and that's dinner. Like they order it not as a dessert, not mm-hmm. as a side. You know, it's not the only time we get ice cream, but it's the only time we have ice cream for a meal, for dinner. And they love it because sometimes, you know, their friends will be over and I'll be like, well, that's it. It's ice cream for you were here, Nick. You were here on this day. You're so excited. And they, you know, confused neighborhood, you know, Nick
kids,
is like,
what?
Oh, this sounds great. This is awesome.
I see in my mind the vision of you guys being at an ice cream parlor and mm-hmm. one of your kids being like, Mom, can I get chicken tenders?
Yeah.
No, it is ice cream for dinner day.
Exactly. You have to follow the rules.
Yeah, there's a system and there's rules always.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on our BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. You can also find us over on SiriusXM Channel 143.
Subscribe to The Lisa Show wherever you get podcasts. That way you will not miss a single moment of this show.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to learn how to help your kids beat summer camp homesickness.
You are listening to The Lisa Show.